Welcome back to The Continent of Resistance, a podcast on labor movements across Asia, and our special series on the striking decade. In the aftermath of the major strike waves across Asia in the 2010s, the initial worker victories in Cambodia, Indonesia, Vietnam, and China were met with increasing government repression and restrictive labor laws. This episode explores the more repressive environment for labor activism, the deepening of neoliberal policies, and how workers are mobilizing beyond the workplace, engaging in broader political movements and structural change. We also touch on the tensions between narrow factory-based industrial struggles and broader class-based movements. We end with a discussion about the growing activism of workers in public sectors and precarious positions who have become more organized following the COVID-19 pandemic.
The strike waves that happened in Cambodia, Indonesia, Vietnam, and China in the decade 2010 unfolded in a complex interplay of economic liberalization, democratization, and labor activism or worker struggles. In the last episode, we talked about strike waves that happened in China and Vietnam in particular, a continuation of workers' actions at the local and workplace level, the learning and the sharpening of skills that workers develop over the course of the decade. In Cambodia and Indonesia, strike waves turned into general strikes in 2012 for the case of Cambodia, for the case of Indonesia, and 2013 for the case of Cambodia. So for this episode, we will talk about what happened after that, the impacts and the responses from the governments and the capital. So Kevin, I would like to come back to China and Vietnam. So can you talk about what happens after that strike waves?
There was a sense in the early 2010s when there were waves of strikes in Vietnam and China. And I think there was a certain expectation things will just continue like that. You know, they will build into bigger and bigger movements, secure bigger gains, and even, you know, manage to maybe create independent union organizations. Unfortunately, this is not what happened. There were crackdowns by government on labor activism. I think overall, you can say that the government's responses shifted from more kind of accommodating and more concessionary approach, you know, in certain ways, accommodating workers' demands to one of repression. I think I should say that in terms of government responses to labor activism in China and Vietnam, it's always a mix of accommodation and repression. So on the one hand, the government will recognize workers' rights, their demands, and the legitimacy of their demands, and make changes to accommodate their demands and interests. But at the same time, they also roll out repressive measures to contain labor activism. But I think the balance decidedly shifted toward repression after this wave of strike in the late 2000s and early 2010s. And you began to see the tightening of civil society. You began to see the more reformist impulses in the state party-controlled trade union federations being put into a more conservative direction. So we see basically the government reacting in a more kind of conservative and repressive way. And I think I should also mention that I think there are other economic factors at play. One, of course, is the workers' wages have been going up in large part because worker struggles, among other reasons, demographics, etc. And as a result of that, capital is looking for other places to invest. They either relocate within those countries or out of those countries. So as a result, also that the willingness of capital to make concessions to workers also diminished. I think all of that result in a much more repressive environment for workers in comparison to the earlier periods. What about Indonesia and Cambodia? What happened after, you know, very impressive and very organized mobilization in 2012, 13, 14? How did those mobilization end and what happened afterwards?
Well, yeah, in Indonesia, the general strike in 2012 and 13 led to a big gains in minimum wage, and the workers can suspend and or stop the government initiatives that specifically about to legalize the flexible employments, right? So that was the result. But you know, unfortunately, for the one following that, for 2015 general strike, the impact was not successful because the government didn't, you know, yield to the pressure. And I think it had to do with the scale of the mobilization that was much smaller, you know. But we, if we look at the, you know, small things or small changes following the general strike, or particularly following the tactics used by workers, like, so there were a lot of changes, like, you know, in particular in the area where workers were taking direct action, you know, in the Bekasi industrial estate in West Java that I mentioned, that were the hotspot of the factory raids. You know, employers retaliated in response to the strike by, you know, prohibited workers from taking their motorbike to work, for example, right? Or installing CCTVs and hiring gangster and thugs, you know. So there were responses like that at the local scale. But at the national level, we know one thing is governments changed the minimum wage determination system from being fixed or determined at the national level to the local and provincial level, which it's a tactic that governments try to avoid workers mobilizing around that issue nationally, right? That's one response. But in 2020, we know there's omnibus laws that has a lot of negative impact on workers, right? So this is a response that happened. But in Cambodia, you know, because the general strikes in Cambodia met with a violent crackdown, so we know two things, right? One is in 2016, the government has the labor and trade union law that was pretty draconian. And we see impact on the labor movement that after 2013 and 14, we haven't seen a large scale mobilization like that up until NACA World Strike, right? Which happens, I think, which coincide with the pandemic.
So what do you think explains, or what are some of the factors you can identify that may help us understand the shift, right? So in early periods, it also sounds like, despite repression, also the governments in Cambodia and Indonesia were more willing to make more, you know, labor friendly or more, you know, more protective measures. But it seems now they kind of, would you say they reversed their approach to labor and became more, also similarly became more repressive? What do you think, if that's the case, what do you think explains that change?
Yeah, I think you were right to talk about accommodation and repression. Well, right after the general strike in Cambodia, you know, in 2014, after the crackdown, you know, later that year, as I mentioned in the earlier episode, you know, Sikadu mobilized workers to achieve a raise in minimum wage. And that was a form of, we can see that as a form of accommodation, right? Right after a violent crackdown, you know, there was a lot of attention paid from international and a lot of pressure from outside. So yeah, governments has to give workers something, right? Like the case of Indonesia, there were also, you know, new regulation that limits strikes or make strikes harder. So I would say, you know, not only this immediate or small responses to what workers did, but bigger responses or structural changes, as we mentioned, the law in Cambodia and the law in Indonesia, you know, are symptomatic of, you know, the way in which the governments and the capital are kind of gaining back what they see as workers' advances, right, or a threat. A let me go back to the example of job creation law, right? The what we call the omnibus law in Indonesia that was championed by the President Joko Widodo in 2020. The law eliminated maximum term limits for temporary contracts, broadened the types of work that could be outsourced, abolished sectorial minimum wages, and stripped workers of paid leave rights, right? You, when you hear all of this, you can see that, you know, these laws actually intended to eradicate protections, social protections, and legal protections for workers, right? And well, we probably need to go back to the very first episode and remind ourselves that, you know, the very reason why these countries open up its market and integrate to a global economy, and you know, what's going on is to invite foreign investment to come, right? And you know, the economy, Indonesia and other countries are still relying on this, you know, investment, relying on the export, relying on some cases tourism, some cases like Cambodia export, right? So it seems obvious to me that the external forces are working really hard, and it's really important for the governments to kind of to please investors, and all they care is about investment and the capital. But workers have been, you know, this pawn in this system to kind of produce profits and do not actually gain much in return, right? I think we need to maybe think about this contradiction that we kind of laid out or set up in the early episodes about this, the integration to the market forces and the worker forces. And, you know, a lot of contradiction that we mentioned, like the idea of free market based on cheap labor, the idea of free market based on, you know, non-existing freedom of associations. And in a sense, the freedom of expressions could also be seen as just, you know, one distraction or a way to kind of limit workers' ability to exercise their rights or power even, right? So yeah, I think this, based on this contradiction, it's not too difficult to understand, but I just want to highlight one gap that we see from all of the mobilizations and worker struggle in the past episode, that there's actually a growing acknowledgement of workers for the gap between the significance of wielding power beyond traditional workplace structures, right? That workers try to manifest in Cambodia, in Indonesia, you know, the big gap between economic organization within the workplace or their power within the workplace and political engagement that they are seeking, right? So I think this is something that probably on the other side of the coin that we're talking about in terms of the shrinking civic space, you know, that they are exercising their power and realizing that their power need to go beyond the workplace, and they're expressing that. And then, you know, all the governments are seeing that clearly, that, well, they are not going to allow workers to go into that space.
Right. And I think that's just, you know, really interesting, the several things you just said. Yeah, one thing is definitely the going back to one of the themes over the series is this deep integration or deepening integration into the global economy, and this need for, or this dependency on foreign investment to generate economic growth. And sometimes as a result of that, you see governments are willing to sacrifice workers' protection so long as they attract investment. And they will sometimes often frame this in terms of protecting jobs, right? So it's a familiar argument that we see governments make, that, well, in order to generate jobs, in order to protect jobs, we have to maybe cut down some of the conditions, but at least you have a job. But very often the result is the job that do end up being created, if they are created at all, are really precarious and insecure, and the wages are low, and it's hardly able to sustain workers living. But I think the other side of this is what you're saying about the increasing strength of workers' movement. This is something we have been recognizing over the last, you know, looking at the last 20 years, when you know, through the continued building of workers' power, through the general strike, through the street mobilization, you really, I think a lot of governments began to see workers as a serious threat to their stability. And I think that also pushed the government into a more to repressive approach.
Let me bring in, to complicate our discussion a little bit, by bringing in the idea of class struggle here, right? We've been talking about worker struggle and we see this contradiction. I mean, for me, I see this clear contradiction in the focus of the existing mechanism that workers have, or mechanism that is provided within the framework, well, and the struggle that's, you know, kind of now exceed beyond the workplace, the realm of the economy or the workplace, right? So I'm really curious about the case of maybe China in particular, about the idea of class struggle and the mechanism that they have and that they use, right? I mean, why I'm asking this question is maybe in the case of China, maybe the idea of, I don't know, class struggle is more pronounced or not, or in that specific context.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, you know, in both the Chinese and Vietnamese context, the socialist government or the Communist Party has always talked about class struggles until the last couple of decades, last two or three decades, when they both turned to more capitalist development policies, measures, etc. And I think now there's a de-emphasizing of class struggle in their ideology, in their rhetoric. But at the same time, you actually see quite, I think, a really interesting development of class struggle. And I think that gets expressed in labor, but also in other peasant struggles. I think that's something similar in Indonesia. There's quite a strong sort of peasant movement. But what I think there is also clear, another dimension to this is class, very clear sort of class formation, both in terms of capitalist class and the sort of solidification of a working class. And a lack of like class mobility, another quite important dimension to this. But I think sort of thinking about class struggle, especially for sort of nominally socialist, quote unquote socialist governments, they're really, really concerned about class struggle because that's how they build their power in the first place. And I think they are very aware of the potential of working class people to topple regime. So they are very cautious about like how to handle, how to manage class conflict, and especially with regard to working class. I mean, how does this manifest with regard to Cambodia, Indonesia? Does that also come up in your research? And do people talk about class struggle at all?
Well, we know that in different contexts, several countries that we work with, we know that there's always this tension between, you know, within the labor movement where workers see themselves, how they see themselves and define themselves, right? So, like on the one hand, we have workers that, you know, define themselves narrowly and, well, maybe see them as part of this industrial relation framework. On the other hand, the workers that try to define their struggle larger and more largely as a class struggle. In Indonesia, for example, in the last general election, we see a faction of trade unions that support the labor parties, right? I think that's maybe the one manifestation of how they say that, oh, you know, we are not only, you know, workers in the sense that the state defined, you know, but we are workers in the larger sense that we are part of this political movement, and they're trying to build the political movement as well. But yeah, I raised this question because, you know, I think we see this tension in our context that workers are being more frustrated or discontent about the mechanism that they have, right? That this is not actually the tools that they could use to make a better change to their working conditions, even we're not to talk about the change the world. I think we, in our context, though, there is also another dimension, which is, you know, this coalition building between unions and NGOs, or, you know, alternative and different forms of organizations that are involved in the campaign or in the advocacy. So, you know, this is another, I think, complication that happened when we mobilized within this context of contradiction, right? But I think you mentioned to me that the strike waves and this or this cycle that we are looking in now that we are zooming out a little bit, we're just talking about industrial workers, right? Yeah. So what's your thought on this?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a good reminder that, you know, throughout the series, our focus is primarily on industrial workers working in export processing zones and other places that primarily cater to the demands of multinational companies and consumer market in the global north. And, you know, even though there are other sectors, workers in other sectors have also been important to the movement, you know, we want to focus on a particular kind of worker, which is industrial workers. And the kind of industrial struggle, factory struggle, is also kind of the classic of, you know, in the history of labor movement, right? It's often what we think built some of the strongest movements. But I think it's also important to know, to be reminded of that. I think increasingly now that because this cycle struggle has been quieting down or may have well ended, we now see workers in other sectors becoming more active. For example, in the online platform sectors, platform workers, riders, food deliveries, etc. And here you also begin to see a lot of them not even seeing themselves as workers. And of course, it's not a new phenomenon, you know, workers in other sectors, maybe in the creative industry that we talk about in our first series of the podcast, in creative industries, in other kind of less industrial or less kind of classic workplace, then you see workers do not necessarily identify themselves as part of the working class. You know, they may see themselves as professionals or part of the middle class. Then this kind of class identity becomes even weaker. I mean, if there was a somewhat stronger identification with a class identity by the industrial worker, I think that's has become even weaker for non-industrial workers, right? So, you know, I think this is brings us to the years following the strike wave and mobilizations. And I think the pandemic was a huge watershed, right? I think it certainly weakened the labor movement that was already weak further. So what do you think are the implications of what happened during the pandemic, and what are the maybe the impacts on both industrial workers, manufacturing workers, but also the emergence of other new forces, new labor forces, such as platform workers or healthcare workers?
We do not talk about other groups of industrial workers, which is, you know, most of them private in the private sector. We are not talking, we haven't really talked about workers in the public sector at all, which is a group that probably less organized or harder to organize in some countries in Southeast Asia, that, you know, they are not actually allowed to have unions or be members of the unions. But as you said, the pandemic kind of like, you know, brings it to the fore that, you know, these sectors that are related to social reproduction, right? Healthcare, education, and so on, they impact our life in the different ways from all of this sectors that we buy or we consume products and commodities. You know, when, for example, in the US, when teachers go on strike, we feel it more than, you know, when workers in private sectors strike. When nurses and doctors go on strike, you know, we feel like our life has been impacted so much more, or transportation, right? So these are the sectors that in the global north are more strategic, right? Because they have that kind of structural power that they can see the impacts of their withdrawal of labor right away. And then you think, I'd like to think about this group of workers in our context, in the Southeast Asian context as well, you know, and it's clear that after the pandemic, workers in these sectors are becoming more and more radical. They're radicalized and they are organized, even though there's still a big tension between, you know, the formal forms of organized labor and trade unions and the non-union forms in Southeast Asia, you know, but I would love to see this converge somehow, you know, because I think it's, we all know that the movement will become much more powerful when we organize cross, you know, not class, but cross sectors.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is such an important point. Like, I think, you know, the labor movement in a lot of places, including Asia, tend to prioritize industrial struggle and, you know, very often for good reasons. Certainly in the last two or three decades, that has been the focal point of worker struggle. A lot of strikes that, you know, that are very visible demonstrations of workers' power. But I think we should definitely pay more attention to other struggles around, you know, instead of just production, but as you mentioned, social reproduction, healthcare, education, and other sectors. And I think it also relates to the, you know, again, to the crisis of neoliberalism. The crisis not only has impact on the productive sector, but also, you know, the reproduction in terms of childcare, elderly care, just healthcare in general, education, because there too, people, I think, have been pushed to the brink. That's why we're seeing such a visible decline in birth rates across Asia, across many places in Asia. I think some of the lowest places with, you know, places with lowest birth rates are in Asia, in Korea, in places like Taiwan, Hong Kong, Japan has always been very low. And I think also now, like increasingly in China as well, it's the first time in the last 5-6 decades when China's population growth actually going to reverse. So I think the population recognize that we just don't have enough resources, money, social production to help us to raise our next generation. So I think that's another sort of locus of center of struggle that we definitely should pay attention to, even though the previous kind of previous cycle of struggle centered around industrial workers may have ended, we may see a new beginning of a new cycle.
Thanks for listening to the Continent of Resistance podcast and our series on the striking decade. I hope you enjoy the conversation and don't forget to subscribe to our podcast.